And we're on. So it is a pleasure to have you on, Erin. And, you know, the topic that we're going to be discussing, I think we're going to stick to this one particular topic, as I found you've suggested it to me, actually. And I actually thought it was a fascinating topic that probably has been relevant for quite a while. And that topic is compliance. But before we get into that topic, just maybe a very brief introduction to yourself and, you know, to your background in ethics and medicine and what you've done and where you're at now.
So I'm a physician. I specialize in psychiatry. And for most of my 15-year career post-residency, I was at the University of California, Irvine, where I was a professor in the School of Medicine. And spent about half my time doing a department of psychiatry related clinical work, teaching, supervision, and research. And the other half of my time, my other job there at the university was I was the director of the medical ethics program. So I helped develop policies at the university that had ethical implications for the hospitals and the clinics and so forth. I chaired the ethics committee that did ethics consultations for patients in the hospital to help patients in the treatment team sort of work through different difficult conundrums or issues, or help them get unstuck if they had a fundamental disagreement about treatment planning and were sort of at an impasse. So that's what I did. I had planned to retire at the university and spend the rest of my career there. I was very involved in the teaching of medical students and residents. But when the vaccine mandate came out, I had serious concerns about that particular policy. And I ended up criticizing university vaccine mandates in the pages of the Wall Street Journal to try to get a conversation going about that policy at the university. And when the university finalized the policy, I started seeing a lot of my colleagues and a lot of students being harmed by it. Students who had the right of informed consent and informed refusal for medical treatments basically taken away from them. And under threat of getting fired or under threat of losing a scholarship or being kicked out of school, many of them were forced to take a novel injection that they may or may not have wanted. So that was really concerning to me. And I made the decision, which I knew would have professional implications, to challenge that vaccine mandate in federal court. So I filed a lawsuit challenging it on 14th Amendment equal protection grounds on behalf of people like me who had natural immunity, who had recovered from COVID. And the university, very swiftly after I did that, placed me on what they called investigatory leave, and then a month later on unpaid suspension, and a month later they fired me. So that was a decision that cost me my job. So on the theme of compliance, I guess I would have been in the category of non-compliance.
Non-compliance, yeah.
In that case, which was new for me. I mean, I was always a person at the university willing to kind of engage in controversial debates, and which I think people in academic medicine should be willing to do. This is, university should be a place where open discussion and debate of publicly controversial policies should take place. But there was something weird about what happened during the pandemic, where public health policies were not allowed to be challenged. And, you know, that bothered me. I think this policy was fundamentally misguided from the beginning based on what we knew about these vaccines and what they could and could not accomplish. And so that was the beginning of me taking a hard look at not only vaccine mandates, but other COVID policies that I had been concerned about. I had been concerned about prolonged lockdowns and prolonged school closures as well. And so last year in 2022 was, you know, me basically leaving the university, setting up a private practice so I could continue seeing my patients, but also continuing to do a lot of work on ethics and public policy, focused on the policies that were rolled out during the pandemic, but also starting to look at some bigger picture
Was it patients as psychiatric patients?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Okay. So I have a like 15-hour a week psychiatric practice, seeing outpatient adults with run-of-the-mill, bread and butter mental health or psychiatric issues, from
so it's
depression,
funny,
anxiety, and you know, addictions, things of that nature.
You know, it's interesting. As we're talking, I'm already envisioning the warning label that YouTube is going to slap on this video. Yeah. I just did an interview recently with Michael Schellenberger, and that one has an environmental warning. And we never even talked about the environment in the entire interview. I mean, it was about homelessness, or a subset of homelessness, I suppose. And it was but you know, it's interesting. So one of the things that you mentioned that that you were in opposition to, or at least skeptical about, was that wasn't being taken into account is natural immunity, which I now have. Hey, I mean, I also did have the vaccine, but hey, that didn't help. Well, maybe. Anyways, natural immunity was something that, a lot of the medical practitioners that I've spoken to or heard from, who were even like incredibly pro-vaccine, they still thought, you know, for any virus in the past, natural immunity was considered to be, you know, the golden standard. And
that's
suddenly,
right,
until it wasn't, suddenly for no apparent reason. And it's just, you know, now in the mainstream, you know, now it's back to accepted, because like, I forget which publication it was.
The Lancet published a paper recently on it. Yeah.
Right. And it was even covered in like a very mainstream media source, like MSNBC or something like that, where they acknowledge, yes, it is. And now it's acceptable to talk about it. So I'm just curious to get your thoughts on that, is where it's sort of how something goes from being, you know, man, you can't say that, even though it's been accepted for so long, to okay, it's okay now. How do we
get
there?
Well, this is a great example of what's happened in the media and public conversation landscape over the last 3 years. I just tweeted the other day, funny how misinformation keeps becoming information. And this is a good example of that. So our knowledge and understanding of natural immunity goes back at least to 430 BC. With the Athenian plague in ancient Greece, where they recognized that people who had recovered from the illness, and it's historians now think that plague was probably a smallpox plague, but those who had recovered from viral or bacterial illnesses didn't get the same illness twice because the immune system learned how to deal with it. And so they would take people with natural immunity, people who had recovered from the illness, and those people would be used to basically care for the sick, because they were a shield against spreading the virus from the sick to those who were naive to the virus and had never encountered it before. So literally for millennia, we've understood how this works. And vaccine science has understood how this works, because what a vaccine tries to do is to mimic to the extent possible natural immunity by triggering the body's immune system to believe it's encountered the virus, either by giving it part of the virus or by giving it an inactivated form of the virus that that can't replicate and can't be spread to other people. But natural immunity is the gold standard that vaccines are trying to achieve. They never fully achieve. They try to get as close as possible to that without making you sick. Right. And so the idea that natural immunity would function differently with this virus was crazy from the beginning. When I got fired, the Los Angeles Times announced, you know, university fires director of ethics who claimed, you know, for declining the vaccine because he claimed he had, quote unquote, natural immunity. So it was this thing you had to put in scare quotes,
right,
as though it wasn't a thing that we've known about, you know, for 2,500 years. And now, again, you could hold the headlines up side by side, those same media outlets. Oh, look at this, the Lancet paper. And what I keep telling people is the Lancet paper is not news. In fact, when I filed my lawsuit, Catherine, we had 150 studies of natural immunity for COVID already demonstrating that it was superior to vaccine immunity. And that was all documentation that I submitted in my lawsuit back in, what was it, August of 2021. But something shifted in the media landscape or the public consciousness that suddenly made it permissible to say that. And I don't know what that was.
No.
I mean, if the government, the public-private censorship regime suddenly decided one day, now we have to leak this, we have to make this okay, or, you know, it's time to move on from this. I'm not saying it's people in a back room somewhere, you know, smoke-filled room making decisions on this, but it is very strange how all of the sudden the public conversation on an issue like this can flip, and something that would have gotten you canceled 6 months ago or censored on social media is now permissible. It's funny you mentioned the warning label. Schellenberg is a friend of mine. So I guess I'm like him, I'm dangerous. So you're probably going to get a warning label for mine. I just did an interview with a guy named Gad Saad who posted the other day that I think it was LinkedIn slapped a warning label on his post. And his post didn't include our interview. It just said, I'm interviewing Dr. Cariotti and we'll post it soon. It was just like,
oh my gosh, so it's just your name.
That's insane.
With Schellenberger, it's just attached to his name, because I tried not to put anything, because I thought maybe it was his bio, but it wasn't. It was just his name. But it is kind of fascinating to look at it. And one thing I do want to be clear on, I mean, of course, there are some people who I do think are not cognitively responsible, I'll put it in this polite way, where, you know, they were like, well, I'm better off, you know, getting natural immunity, meaning that they wanted to get sick so that instead of getting the vaccine, so they can have natural immunity.
Yeah, this was the worry. This was one of the worries about natural immunity. And what I was trying to explain to people about my argument in my case is natural immunity and you know, my claim of equal protection for those who have it is not about encouraging people to rush out and get the virus. It's about the people who have already had the virus and what forms of discriminatory policies are in place that are unjustly punishing those people. So that is an important clarification and distinction. That
like
I
the frontline workers,
anyone to deliberately get the virus. That was not what this whole thing was about. It was about the people who had already had the virus, and therefore we could reassure them that they had good protection. And that, you know, with all the fear around COVID, that should have been a positive public health message. That should have been, you know, this is contributing, along with other interventions, to getting us beyond the pandemic. We should acknowledge that and celebrate the people who have recovered. Obviously, mourn the people who didn't have a good outcome with COVID, and, you know, try to help those who were dealing with the long-term effects of it, and certainly those who are mourning the loss of a loved one. But also, like, look at the positive side. And, you know, 99% of people that encountered this virus, 99%+ of people under the age of 65 who encountered this virus did just fine. And that's actually a good thing.
Yeah. And it, you know, logically it made sense for, if we're talking about, you know, frontline workers, teachers, you know, doctors,
that's
nurses,
right,
who were exposed, who didn't even have the option of getting the vaccine. And here they were getting sick, they were risking their lives. And suddenly they were forced to get, you know, they were already sick, so they had that natural immunity. They didn't choose, they didn't choose that. And suddenly they were having to be sort of poking their immune systems again for no real reason. So, and it is, you know, it was a poke. I mean, I've had, since I have had the vaccine, I know that, and I know with many people, I mean, it was a pretty serious reaction for a lot of people, whether that was justified or not. But, you know, let's talk about some of the other measures, because, and again, I think what's really fascinating about it, it's just, to me, it reveals a lot about humanity and human nature, which we just got in this really compressed time span. That I think is kind of inherent in humanity and indicates a broader issue that isn't specific just to the pandemic. It's just that we saw it so clearly during it. But, you know, some of the things that we talked about earlier, you know, is it 5 meters or 6 meters? The distance rule, for example.
6 feet, 2 meters.
Six feet makes more sense. that's very far. 6 feet. What's behind that? I mean, I think there's nothing behind it, but what's behind it?
There was bad science behind it. So initially we were being told that COVID spread through respiratory droplets and it was not aerosolized. So what is the distinction between those two, insofar as there is a distinction, there are some scientists who think, setting that aside, the notion was COVID spreads through, think about the stuff that you see visibly come out of your mouth when you cough or sneeze, right? That can land on a surface and that can go no more than 6 feet away. That's what spreads COVID, little droplets of, you know, whatever that come out of your mouth and nose. Well, before long, we quickly realized that no, COVID is aerosolized, meaning it's in the invisible gas in the air and it spreads evenly throughout a room. So it doesn't matter how far apart you are from another person with an aerosolized virus. What matters for an aerosolized virus is the number of infected people in a room, the size of that room, and the duration of time spent in that room. And the way that you try to reduce the risk of contagion with an aerosolized virus is not by spreading people apart, but by better ventilation. So opening the windows. So another piece of the 6 foot thing that we saw going up all over the place that was scientifically ludicrous were the plastic barriers, right? Or the plastic barrier mask that clearly, I mean, even with a cloth mask and even with an N95, which most people, when you wear an N95 in a hospital, you have to get it fit tested. You have to do a thing to make sure that, you know, you shave your beard, and it's very complicated to get it right.
And it hurts because it's so tight.
You can't wear it for more than 2 hours. It's actually very bad for you. You're rebreathing CO2. It's not those cannot be used in community settings without causing people a lot of respiratory harms. Actually, the harms would clearly outweigh any potential benefit. So with a cloth mask or a surgical mask, if you have glasses, you notice, you know, my glasses fog up when I wear the mask. Well, that means it's not working to stop an aerosolized virus. So instead of plastic barriers, which actually impede airflow, what we should have done is open all the windows in the car or in the classroom, or installing new ventilation systems in buildings and airplanes. That was a reasonable, sensible response to what we were dealing with. Plastic barriers, mask mandates, 6 foot distance, you know, stand here on top of this thing at the grocery store. It was theater. It was absurd.
Did the mask diminish it at all? Like, they don't stop, but do they minimize anything?
So we just got published. This is another issue where suddenly it's become okay to publicly say masks don't work, because there was a Cochrane review published about 2 weeks ago, and a Cochrane consortium is this independent entity. It's based out of the UK that's supposed to be free of all financial and other conflicts of interest with industry. They do a pretty good job of that, although you could argue that some of their reviews have been compromised based on who did it. But at least within mainstream medicine, Cochrane reviews are supposed to be the gold standard level of evidence. So this was a Cochrane review looking at 78 randomized controlled trials of masks. and they concluded masks don't work, including N95s. Before the pandemic, we had 15 randomized controlled trials of masks for respiratory viruses like influenza, all 15 of them negative. So the gold standard level of evidence, which is a randomized controlled trial, had 15 negative and no positive studies before COVID. Now we have 78 studies, randomized controlled studies that were reviewed in this recent Cochrane review. And the results confirmed what we should have already known. And it's interesting, I went back and looked at, because your theme is compliance. This is, the masks are maybe the most interesting COVID policy in this regard, because the original WHO rationale for recommending masks, if you look at the reasons that they gave, one of the reasons that they gave, the reasons were very thin on science. One of the reasons that they gave was to get people used to complying with public health directives. And they literally said it there.
Oh, wow. Where does it say it?
This was the original WHO. This was a document that they prepared that was supposed to be kind of like for public health officials, like your local county health officer. Our recommendation for masks is based on these reasons, right? And they there were bullet points. That was one of the bullet points. Another one of the reasons that sometimes slipped out. Anthony Fauci actually alluded to this early on when he flipped on masks and started recommending them, was that masks at least gave people something to do, right? So we had a situation in which we have an invisible pathogen. We had another myth that was propagated early on, was the myth of asymptomatic spread, that even people without symptoms could spread it. We now know that, first of all, respiratory viruses are never primarily driven. Respiratory epidemics are never primarily driven by asymptomatic spread. And the same is true of COVID. We know that now. It's very, very clear. But at the time, there was this worry that basically every other person out there could potentially be a threat to my existence. That's terrifying. People can't live and function like that. It's a crippling level of fear and anxiety, right? And masks at least gave people some sense of control. It's a simple thing that I can do. And if I do it, and if other people do it, I feel a little bit safer. I can regain some sense of agency and control in a situation in which I feel like there's this all-pervasive threat and there's very little that I can do to protect myself or to control it. And public health officials recognize that. And part of the reason that they went ahead and endorsed masks and even mask mandates was psychological, really, was to give people some sense that they could do something. The problem with that, though, is that people have become so conditioned to wearing these masks that they don't feel safe without them, and they can't relinquish them, even in the face now of overwhelming evidence. And I would say the Cochrane review should be the nail in the coffin on masks. But I've had patients, I remember an adolescent patient who the mask mandate was lifted at her school. And she told me, I'm still going to wear a mask to school, even though they're not requiring it. And I asked her if she was worried about COVID. She was not. She had already had COVID. And she said, I'm wearing it because I don't want to show my face.
It's very interesting, because I think I've gone through all those motions myself.
Yeah.
I was one of the people, I think it's important to sort of admit to where we were at certain points. and I will say that I was someone who did sort of subscribe to the mask thing. I was scared. I sprayed my groceries when, you know, that was a thing. It was very difficult, even when I knew that was nonsense. Like, once we all sort of found that out, even once people stopped, I had a hard time stopping, because I have some
issues around that. You had a sense of I'm doing something. Yeah.
There is a control, but also I already have some issues around stuff like that. So, it was difficult for me to stop. I did give people looks, I think, when they didn't wear masks, because I'm like, well, you're inconsiderate. I wouldn't say anything, but I'm like, you were inconsiderate. Yeah. Because at the time, I believed that masks worked, even those flimsy, you know, the the really bad ones, right? The bandana, ones made out of fabric, you know? Yeah, I didn't think the bandana ones worked, but weirdly, I believe that the fabric ones surely did. Or silk, you know, I have a whole bunch of silk ones. There is a sense of, yes, control. The asymptomatic thing, I absolutely, I mean, you probably just dispelled that one for me now. So I believed it till today. So all of those things, and it's difficult once you, it's even just something about the tradition, just the doing it, just when you do it, I'm missing the word that I mean to use, well, but
it does something for you. It's like, I put it on and my fear, my anxiety level just goes down a notch. And so why wouldn't you keep doing something that makes you feel a little bit safer, better?
Well, even just, you know, you brush your teeth every day. And I guess, exactly. I mean, there's a purpose to that, but the ritual, that's the word I was looking for.
Right.
And there are people around me who still, you know, wear masks. I mean, most people still wear masks. And the really ridiculous part that I found, because I still, you know, I just still, like, I'm logical, try to be logical. So once I had extra facts, I did sort of change my behaviors. But for example, you know, I'll go to a coffee shop and there'll be people there who will wear a mask while they're ordering the coffee, sit down, take the mask off, enjoy their time drinking coffee, then put the mask back on to go outside where there's not even any people and fresh air. Or airplanes, like masks on airplanes. As you said, like filtration systems, right? Like the safest, probably one of the safest places to be. And maybe I'm wrong on the science. Like this is from what I've read and heard. It's like the filtration in an airplane is actually one of the strongest.
Right.
So it's actually probably one of the safest places to be. So the mask is actually less necessary there than many other places, if you believe the masks work.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that we're doing that are not like really logical. And the people who are wearing these bandanas or the mask under the nose thing, and those are people who do believe that masks work. That's the thing. That's what I don't understand. It's like,
I think it's even more than it's even more than just a belief that masks work, because we're operating on the social and psychological and relational level in very complex ways that, you know, don't always have to do with empirical science. Why did people go through the ritual? You know, here you had to wear the mask when you walked into the restaurant, but you could take it off when you sat down and ate. Everyone knows that can't make any logical sense. You don't have to be a virologist or an epidemiologist to understand that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But everyone did it as kind of an indication of social solidarity, or I care about you, or I care enough about the common good to sort of like be a part of this and try to do my part, which is a fundamentally good pro-social instinct, right? But the problem is when that is leveraged and misapplied and misused by people in power who like this because it confers, you know, it conditions people into being compliant and not asking questions, even for things that are obviously logically nonsensical. And that's a worrisome trend as well, that when you take advantage of people's goodwill, I think there's very few people operating during the pandemic that had outright malice. I think there are some bad actors who took advantage of things for economic gain or for political power or, you know, for other reasons. But I think most people are fundamentally decent people and want to do good and want to do right and don't want to kill grandma and, you know, want to contribute to society. And so compliance at that level is probably a good thing for most people to do most of the time. We have conventions and courtesies that we sort of abide by. But what happened, another reason that masks were important for social control is that they were visible, right? And one of the reasons the unvaccinated really bothered people is because you couldn't identify them, right? You know, with the vaccine passport system, that was one attempt at certain to have a kind of checkpoint Charlie system where at certain points access was granted only to those who were clean or not dangerous or whatever. But most of the time you can't tell who's vaccinated and unvaccinated, but you can tell who's masked and unmasked and who's, you know, friend or foe in that regard. And so I think one of the reasons that masking continued to be pushed by public health authorities much longer than the evidence warranted was some of that initial notion that, number one, it gives people a sense of control, and that's maybe psychologically helpful. And two, it also separates the sheep from the goats. And, we can tell who the troublemakers are going to be. Cariotti's going to out himself because he doesn't want to wear the mask. Whereas, with other things, it's harder to tell. Have you been vaccinated or not? You know, do you
How
always
conscious do you think that was for them? Because, what's sort of the,
It was conscious enough that some of them basically put it in writing. I mean, I think the WHO more or less put it in writing. I'll try to pull the exact quote for you when I sign off here from that document. But when you read it now, it's actually very striking in retrospect.
That is striking to even
kind of
to hear that.
Kind of frightening.
And I look at that. I mean, there's so many sort of outright illogical things, like, the obvious for many people, but we were like, whispering this amongst ourselves. Like, it was like controversial, even though it shouldn't be. Like, you go to a restaurant, but you're suddenly protected by this pixie glass, but also which some of them had, some didn't, but also it's okay to take your mask off to eat, but not okay to enter the restaurant. It made no sense.
Exactly.
And, or things like I recently, this is very recent. I went to visit a friend, at a care center, and, nowhere do they ask you anymore for the vaccine passport. So I never even thought that this is something that would be required. But so they asked for vaccine passport, and I actually still had it on my phone, which is like, I didn't even know if I had it. And I was quite pissed off, actually. My friend didn't know if she had, and she traveled all that way to go there. But on the other hand, and they required a COVID test, which actually of all of the things, I think that is a reasonable ask.
Reasonable.
I was fine with that. But what was interesting, I found out with the COVID test, it was okay to actually do that at home and just kind of give you a word that you were clear. But the vaccine passport, that was mandatory to show.
You had to show digital proof. Yeah.
I had to show digital proof. Yeah. But the other thing, that was fine just to do one of those, and just tell them. And I thought that was just made no sense. So things like that. But the fact that, if you challenged any of it, and I remember because I did, I certainly started challenging all of that, and I started posting, and it was like scary because I would get attacked. Mm-hmm. It was different if I did it in person with my friends, because they knew I was like a pretty, not a conspiracy theorist, right? That's the word that everybody was like afraid of being labeled. But if I did it in any public way, you just get attacked and labeled all sorts of things. And it's like, what is it that kind of allows people to go into these mental states where they are afraid to challenge? So one, it seems to be this peer pressure element, but two, I think a lot of people just accept. I don't think they even have these thoughts of doubt or skepticism. What do you think? What would you attribute that to?
I think there's a lot that's up operating on the unconscious level for people. So again, let's go back to the initial state in which we were in that I think people got conditioned into, where with the threat of asymptomatic spread, every other person is a potential threat to my existence, which is a really intolerable existential state. And that, you know, we can only all be safe if everyone is safe. Therefore, the dissidents or the people asking inconvenient questions or the people who are not going along with the program, even if it's part of the program that seems illogical to everyone, like mask when you stand up, take it off when you sit down. If bad things are happening, then those people can be blamed, right? So there is a scapegoating mechanism that occurs over and over historically in various societies. René Girard, who's a former professor at Stanford, has described this in detail in many different books. But he talks about it in the context of human beings are mimetic creatures. We imitate not just one another's behaviors, but we imitate one another's desires, right? And that can create situations of social tension and conflict. And that conflict is often resolved, as he showed in his work, through this scapegoating mechanism, which temporarily can let off some steam. And I think we saw that at work during the pandemic, right? Everyone's doing everything right, or almost everyone's doing everything right. And, you know, the virus is still spreading. People are still getting sick. People are still getting hospitalized. All of us have had our lives turned upside down, and you know, we still supposedly can't get back to normal. It must be the fault of these holdouts or these dissidents. And so people will, even as a way to feel connected to and part of something socially bigger than me, they can turn on minority populations or the scapegoated population with incredible levels of vengeance and fury, and scapegoating and canceling. This is not a new phenomenon that happened during COVID. It's a repeated phenomenon that's occurred over and over and over again in history. But I think COVID provided a particularly intense laboratory where those social dynamics played out, because the level of anxiety and tension in society was so high that we needed release valves. We needed a way to, we needed cathartic ways to deal with that pervasive, prolonged level of fear and anxiety. And we needed ways to exercise social solidarity. I mean, you think about all of these measures separated people from one another. Right. You talk about compliance, right? One way to more easily control people is to isolate them. This is what abusive people do, right? They isolate the person who's being abused from their friends and their family, and then they're more easily controlled. Well, all of us were forced to interact only behind screens. We couldn't have face-to-face encounters. You know, we had to look to an authority to tell us what to do. This is not an easy way to live. There's going to be a lot of, this is going to create a lot of anger and resentment that it needs to be displaced somewhere. And I think very often our authorities, our governing authorities, were perfectly happy to allow that to be displaced onto people who didn't wear masks, or I think it was especially pronounced with unvaccinated people. I mean, so many unvaccinated people have reached out to me talking about the absolute hatred and vitriol and fury that was directed toward them. It was incredible, really incredible.
It was, and seeing how quickly people sort of the level of dehumanization that was able to happen just because of that choice was very striking. And that two-tiered system and all of that, mm-hmm. just observing that happening the way that it did, it was just it was incredible. And so of course now you have people incredibly, understandably, angry and upset and hurt, but in ways that I, you know, that I think are manifesting themselves in ways that I think are going to be very tough to resolve. And they're very kind of hateful to the other side, which like, I get it, but also like, it's like, how do you move from, how do you move from there? Right. Yeah, 'cause I think it's turning.
Vengeance is not the answer. And, you know, people calling for Nuremberg 2.0 and you know, hang them. So what I've been trying to promote in this regard is a truth and reconciliation model. You know, the CDC a few months ago, very quietly, didn't really get reported very much, very quietly in their new guidance said we shouldn't discriminate between the vaccinated and unvaccinated for two reasons. The same reasons I articulated in my lawsuit 2 years ago. Number one, the vaccines don't stop infection and transmission. And number two, most people have natural immunity, which is quite robust, right? So just quietly. But there was never any acknowledgement on the part of the public health authorities when they flipped on that, that you know, perhaps our policies in the past that encouraged discrimination in that regard were harmful to some people or were misguided. And you know, we apologize for the harms that were done. So when the Atlantic piece came out about pandemic amnesty from Emily, I'm forgetting her name, but that created quite a buzz. It's basically this doctor who said, well, a lot of mistakes were made during the pandemic. And it was as the tide was starting to turn on, you know, some of these policy issues and people were recognizing that, you know, lockdowns probably did more harm than good. And gosh, the effects of school closures are going to be felt for decades. And she was sort of saying, well, nobody really knew what was going on and we should let bygones be bygones and just declare an amnesty. And I was sympathetic to the idea of moving forward and healing society, but I thought her proposal was superficial and wouldn't work. And the proposal made a lot of people really, really angry. And I think the reason why is, you know, first of all, when people say nobody really knew what was going on early in the pandemic, that's not true. There were a lot of people from the very beginning that pushed back against these misguided pandemic policies, but we were censored and silenced and canceled. And so that projected a false sense of a scientific consensus that wasn't actually there. It's just that one side of the debate was not allowed to be heard by the general public. So it's not true that nobody knew what was going on. There were people that didn't know what was going on, but they were punished. They were silenced. But the other piece of this, and the reason I think that the truth and reconciliation model is important is there have been commissions in South Africa after apartheid, in Rwanda after the genocide there, called truth and reconciliation commissions. There's sort of a model for how to do this. But truth and reconciliation that begin with truth. Right? You can't just jump to reconciliation without truth. And the truth often involves, you know, people taking responsibility for decisions that were made, acknowledging when they made mistakes, and apologizing for the harms that were done and making some attempt to rectify those harms when possible. Sometimes it's not possible to rectify harms, right? People were injured by your bad policy or they were irreparably harmed by your bad policy. Okay, but I mean, anyone who is fired over the issue of vaccine mandates should be rehired with back pay. That's something that can be rectified, right? And then we can begin to move toward reconciliation. But that's actually a really hard process. It's a humbling process. It requires real leadership and, you know, real intellectual humility from people in power. I mean, if you look at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the Rwandan genocide, this involved person A standing up in front of person B saying, I was responsible for killing your family and I am sorry, or I failed to protect your family when I could have, and now they're dead and I'm sorry. I mean, that's
And
hard.
how realistic is it, given that so many people I think are still
Not gonna happen.
in no.
Not gonna happen. Not gonna happen. No, I mean, our leadership class is not made up of people who will ever apologize for mistakes, by and large. They see that as a threat to their power rather than a manifestation of real leadership, which I think, most Americans would recognize that that's a manifestation of real leadership, to admit that when you change your mind or when you were wrong, to admit that perhaps I listened to the wrong advice in this regard, and I'm sorry. If I could go back, I might do things differently. That's real leadership, but
Think so too.
that's
Yeah.
rare in our, certainly in our political class. I think most of our leadership class, they're just not built that way. I don't see it happening,
No.
unfortunately. I think it would be great if it did happen, but I
And it's
don't
so
see it
different
happening.
how things went in the West, where, supposedly we're so freedom loving, but, in Japan they did say, don't discriminate against people. So it's interesting how
They did. That's
culturally
right.
it was a different, there was such a difference there. It's interesting. Like, to me, I don't think I've ever expected freedom to be taken away so quickly, in such a way, especially in this in the in you know in, within North America. I mean, it was taken in a lot of places. I don't think it was as a lot of things weren't as stigmatized as they were, or censored, I think, as they were here. I spoke to people in other countries, and it seems like discourse was a lot more open. Now they might have their level of compliance was actually in many countries pretty high as well. But the stigmatization wasn't there in the same way. So, I talked to people in South Korea, and they were able to go, there were places they could still go to restaurants, but they did have to sort of sit in other places, but they weren't like necessarily shamed. That wasn't a thing. With the masks, it was also a bit different. Like, at the very least, they provided the N95 masks, made them cheaper, fabricated. So at least they were going based on some level of science, even though it's still, like you mentioned, you can only really wear them for a couple of hours and they're not so good for you. But at least they weren't those like flimsy things. So it
Yeah, they
wasn't,
weren't
there was
doing
some
pure
basis. They
theatrics.
weren't
They
doing
were,
pure theatrics, right? So
yeah,
the at least
right.
makes me think that the thought behind it was a little bit different.
Sure.
So it's interesting where our sort of leadership was coming from as opposed to other cultures. And but also, like, looking at it like from a historical context, I mean, again, we're this is not a unique time in history. Compliance. And also, even in our own lives, I mean, we've always had to comply to certain extents, and there's levels to it, like you mentioned, that are healthy, right? If we're doing it to sort of take care of each other as a society, we're looking out for each other, it makes logical sense to do so. Great. I think that's an important factor. But we've also had tremendous compliance that has led to many deaths, the most obvious examples being, genocides and things like that.
Right. That's right.
Like, so what is it like? I mean, there's something about humans that I think is also very tribal that leads them to comply with the worst things.
Which is a good thing most of the time and a terrifying thing under the wrong circumstances. I was personally dismayed at how easily and without asking questions people in this country and other supposedly free Western nations relinquished certain rights and freedoms that hadn't been relinquished. What we relinquished under lockdowns, the right of free association, the right of the freedom of movement and travel, the right to bury our loved ones. Or attend a wedding, to be present with those nearest and dearest, the most important milestones and moments of lives, we gave up without question. These were rights that were not relinquished, for example, by the citizens of London during the Nazi bombing of the city in World War II. I mean, they had curfews, but they never locked down the city. They never told people you can't leave your homes or you have to work from home. So I was dismayed and somewhat shocked at the lack of willingness to challenge some of these things. In retrospect now, and I think censorship is probably a topic for a different conversation that we could have, but in retrospect now, just seeing how pervasive and effective the censorship regime on social media was, and we now know that some of that was government-sponsored censorship, you know, that I would argue violated the First Amendment rights of Americans. It makes more sense, you know, when you start seeing, okay, on one side of these debates, it wasn't that no one asked questions, but that those questions were silenced. And one of the reasons this is really concerning to me, Catherine, and, you know, at the risk of sounding overblown or apocalyptic, there is the seed. I'm not saying we're living in a totalitarian society or that we were living in a totalitarian society during the pandemic, but the seed of totalitarian tendencies was planted there. And what I mean by this is, you know, when you say the word totalitarian, most people think of concentration camps and, you know, secret police and men in jackboots and, you know, mass surveillance. We actually had mass surveillance during the pandemic.
And we had people in boots. I mean, people were being arrested for not wearing masks and being past curfew.
Powers of the state backing up a lot of these things. But those weren't even the most concerning thing to me. There's a political theorist named Eric Voegelin who, among other things, studied the 20th century totalitarian systems. And he said the central feature of all totalitarian systems is not any of those things, secret police, concentration camps, mass surveillance, as horrifying as all of those things are. He said that the central feature of all totalitarian regimes is the prohibition of questions, the inability to ask questions, the inability to raise your hand and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, this, whatever Nazi or Marxist doctrine doesn't make any logical sense. That's where things begin. And that's a shift that happens in society before all the other apparatus of the totalitarian state gets built. And in fact, in the perfect totalitarian society, you no longer need secret police and mass surveillance and concentration camps to enforce a rigid social order, because people internalize the prohibitions or the rules. And that internalization can become so deep and pervasive that it no longer occurs to people to ask questions, to challenge Nazi racial doctrine, or to challenge, you know, Soviet Marxist class conflict doctrine, or whatever, you know, whatever the thing is that you're not allowed to ask questions about. That's the worst form of imprisonment, right? When the logical questions no longer occur to you because you've so internalized the ruling ideology. So that to me is the most unsettling part of what happened during the pandemic to so many people, is that they lost the ability to ask questions.
So the antidote to all of this is ultimately being able to ask more questions, right?
Yeah, what I tell people is, you, because we were told to listen to the experts, and there is a place for expertise, don't get me wrong. You know, there's a kind of populist disdain for any claim of expertise, which is exaggerated and goes too far. But inescapably complex political decisions, like whether to lock down an entire society, cannot be answered by any one or another expert, right? You can't just look at COVID case curves. You have to look at the 100 other knowable effects of a policy like that and the 1,000 other imponderables that would never occur to you. I mean, this is an inescapably prudential political decision that requires a lot of input from a lot of different people, and not just you know, a handful of epidemiologists looking only at COVID case counts. But our politicians, as a way of relinquishing responsibility for their decisions, said, we're just following the science, we're just following the experts. What they usually meant was, you know, we're following the public health bureaucrats that we have appointed to do what we want. You know, people thought they were following the science, but they were really just following the television, right? What they were saying on CNN and Fox and so forth. So what I tell people is, okay, you may not be an expert in epidemiology or virology or, you know, public policy for that matter, but there is a place for expert opinion to obviously to inform these decisions, but you are like every adult of sound mind, a person capable of rational thought. You're capable of spotting a logical contradiction. You know, you're capable of recognizing if the so-called expert talking head on TV is saying the exact opposite this week of what he said last week without any acknowledgement that he's changed his mind and without any explanation of why he's changed his mind. So don't outsource your logic and your common sense to so-called experts, right? This is an empowering message that I think is central to a democratic society, that, you know, every person and every person's opinion matters and counts for something. And a kind of technocratic rule by experts is, that's not a society that I want to live in. And I value education and I value expertise. And, you know, I even claim to have some level of expertise in some areas based on my training and clinical experience and so forth. So I don't want to denigrate that, but I think things swung so far in the direction of actually disempowering ordinary citizens to think and to ask questions. That's not a recipe for a healthy society. And I think it's time, as we're coming out of this pandemic fog, for people to kind of reclaim their, you know, my gut told me that there was something funny about this. And, you know, now the people on TV are saying, oh yeah, it turns out, you know, that was a useless thing or a bad idea. Maybe I should have listened to my instincts a little more. Maybe I should have been a little more willing to ask questions about these policies.
I think that's a great note to end on. And I'll also add that, you know, find experts that, because I also think that experts are important, because you can't be an expert in everything. But find those people, you know, figure out how to evaluate which experts are mm-hmm. worth your trust, and mm-hmm. then, you know, listen to those and listen to contradictory yeah. opinions, and then decide.
Find experts that disagree with one another.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. That have credible expertise and training, but that disagree on this or that issue, this or that point, and listen to their debate. Right. When you shut down debate,
that's the one thing that should never happen. Like you said, I think the key is you should always be able to ask questions. And I think the people who I would be very skeptical of people who think that it's not acceptable to ask questions. Yeah. So, but I think there might need to be a part two to definitely let's do it. Well,
lots
thank
more
you
to
so
talk about.
For sure. There's lots of for more forbidden conversations. I just hope they won't get forbidden. But I appreciate you being with me, Aaron, and great chatting with you as always.
Great to be with you again, Catherine, and thank you for the work that you're doing to have these conversations about these kind of neuralgic lightning rod issues. Appreciate your open-mindedness and your, you know, your willingness to hear both sides of these debates.
Absolutely.
It's refreshing.
And I'm learning a lot, and I'm like, I'm my mind is never made up, and I'm always going back and forth, which is
good.
I don't know, sometimes it's a good thing, and sometimes it keeps me up at night, but I think it gives me a lot of thoughts, you know. And listen, here's the thing, that this is a good question to ask anybody who's feels certain about anything. You say, have you ever been wrong about anything? And I don't think there's a single person who's not lying who's going to say.
Just so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. No, that's a very good starting point for people. And I mean, I obviously have strong opinions about COVID policies and other issues related to it. But I hope that I'm still open-minded enough to, you know, be proven wrong on, you know, this or that claim. And I hope I do change my mind on some things down the road, and I can publicly acknowledge that I have changed my mind and what changed my mind and why. I think that's important for all of us.
I think so. I think that's the key.